Like what you've heard? Listen again online at drewmarshall.ca.
Lord of this dark field, Ancient of days, Universe maker, here's a song in your praise.
Well, especially in recent years, religion and politics have gone hand in hand in the United States of America. Particularly in the polarizing cases of abortion, gay rights, and high school science curriculums, the division between conservative and liberals has hinged more and more on religious and moral questions. Frank Schaefer has been on both sides of these debates, and in Crazy for God, he tells how the religious right was formed and chronicles his own role in organizing the political efforts of religious fundamentalists. He grew up in Le Brie, a community in Switzerland founded by his evangelical parents, who were instrumental in linking the efforts of the American evangelical community with the anti-abortion movement. But this book is also a personal memoir, a very personal memoir. We learn of Francis Schaefer's coming of age as an evangelist and his eventual crisis of faith that changed his heart. And Francis Schaefer is a fiction and nonfiction writer. Many of you will know his work. He's written for USA Today, The Washington Post, The San Francisco Chronicle, The LA Times. He's a regular contributor to the Huffington Post website and blog, and he has appeared on Oprah, Fox News, CNN, ABC's 2020, and today he's on The Drew Marshall Show. Quite a story, quite a read. How did this whole thing start with you? And what I mean by that, Frank, is you changing from what you grew up in?
Well, let me work backwards. I'm 57 years old. I have three grown children and three grandchildren, and I find myself today as an avid supporter of Barack Obama, someone who voted for him and wrote for 2 years about his campaign in the Huffington Post. Working backward from that, if you went back to 1970 and the early 70s, I was my father, Francis Schaefer's sidekick on the American evangelical scene. We were, you know, preaching from Jerry Falwell's pulpit on the 700 Club with Pat Robertson, one of the people who helped Dr. Dobson get going. In between that time and this time, obviously, I've been through some changes, and that's what the book chronicles. And really, it's the story of someone who realized that he had grown up in a fundamentalist family, but began to think that really this was more of an inherited view than something he believed in himself. And really, the story that's told in Crazy for God is one that I think is shared certainly by a lot of North Americans, Canadians, and here in the U.S., and that is that we have a conversion experience or we grow up in a Christian family, but as time goes by, we begin to rethink some things. And really what this book is about is rethinking not just the politics, but also the faith issues. And so that's really the story of a personal journey, but it's also the story of a country that, you know, for the last 40 years has been in the grip of a politics that comes from the far right and now has liberated itself from that politics with the election of our first African-American president. But beyond that is also a religious history of a movement and seen from a very personal perspective, which is mine, being the son of someone who I guess you could describe as evangelical royalty in terms of America, which doesn't mean that our family was known outside of the evangelical circles, but within those circles, if you had asked an American evangelical who the two or three most important evangelical thinkers were, say, in 1980, my father would have been at either at the top of the list or one of those people on the list along with C.S. Lewis or whomever else. Hmm. And so that's my background.
You know, I wonder how much of your, and forgive me for phrasing it this way, but, you know, no matter how you slice it, you've rebelled from the shadows that you grew up in. So sure. I wonder how much of your rebellion in all of this was due to the cultural environment you grew up in. In other words, had you simply grown up within the context of the North American psyche and subculture as opposed right. to the Swiss culture, maybe you wouldn't be such a counterculture jerk.
Yeah, no, I understand what you're saying. You know, to give the book a context, you there's one point you have to understand. I'm a professional writer. I do this for a living. You know, people say, well, why did you write this book? Well, in one sense, the honest answer is it was my next book. The book before that was a novel by the name of Baby Jack about a Marine who's killed in Iraq. And Before that, I had written a number of books about my son who served in the Marine Corps, who thank God was not killed, Keeping Faith that I was on Oprah with, and other subjects. So it isn't as if I was living some non-writerly life and suddenly I had this big thing I wanted to unburden myself about. It was really the other way around, and that is I've been working up toward writing this memoir, not only on my own life, but just this whole evangelical movement in the American context, for a number of years, and I've kind of worked around it in the sense that I've written some semi-biographical novels called the Calvin Becker Trilogy, Portofino, Zermatt, and Saving Grandma, that have had quite a following among people who read novels, but also among former and current evangelicals who kind of feel that I write about that vibe of this subculture with some accuracy. And after many years of doing this and sort of nibbling all the way around this cookie, I finally decided to actually take a bite and tell the, you know, real story of not just our family, but this whole cultural development of the religious right as I experienced it. So, you know, I don't claim this is a history or even accurate. It's simply a subjective point of view of one person, but it tells this story, and I guess in some ways, you know, is a little bit of a slice of American history in that it shows where a lot of things came from that I think a lot of people find very mysterious. You know, where all of a sudden, you know, did the Bushes come from? Why do you have this, you know, ruling class from the right wing that suddenly has this vote it can count on from evangelicals no matter what they do? Well, part of that was because people like my father and I went around and helped establish the pro-life movement, and that turned from being the pro-life movement into essentially the basis of the Republican Party that they could count on. Whether they did anything about abortion or not was beside the point. It was a kind of a reaction against the left. And so I think my book explains some of this in a way that people who have lived it or been part of it find interesting or maybe even accurate and a reflection of what really happened.
You see, as Canadians, we don't really grasp the concept of wrapping our Bible in the flag.
Right.
It's a foreign thing to us.
Right.
You can be a Christian and be part of the NDP up here, you know.
Right.
So, again, I'm thinking of this sort of Swiss. I mean, what were the ages you grew up over there in Switzerland?
Well, you know, in a way, actually, for a Canadian audience, I'm a little more down home than your average North American USA guy because I grew up in Europe. I speak French for a start, so I get on fine in Quebec, and I grew up there, and I went to British private schools until I ran away from one when I was 15. Went back to Switzerland, the story I tell in the book, and so forth and so on, and then, you know, got my hippie princess from San Francisco, Jeannie, pregnant when she was 17, and we had Jessica, our baby, who, by the way, now is a mother of two lovely children. And so I was really part of two things which are not really your typical middle-class American Christian background. First of all, because LaBrie, my parents' ministry, was open to all comers, we really were heart and center of the hippie movement in the early 60s. And before that, I was really raised as a European, expatriate American, but knew much more about European culture than I did North America. And that was one of the things that shocked me when I came over here with my father and began to speak in places like Wheaton College and Jerry Falwell School and so forth, was just the fact that this seemed like I'd gone to another planet. I mean, LaBrie was an open community. We took care of people. Gay people came and were not made to feel unwelcome. We had pregnant mothers there who were not married and were helping to care for them. I came to North America and all of a sudden ran into people like Dr. Dobson and Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson and others who I got to know quite well personally as I was on their shows and so forth with my dad. And really, it had almost nothing to do with the kind of evangelical, compassionate Christianity I had been raised with and was much more to do with access to power and fundraising than it was anything to do with the compassion of extending the love of Jesus Christ to people on a personal basis, which is what my family had really been all about. So I sort of became a fish out of water, and it took a while to get my bearings, but once I did, you know, I left that. But I'd like to quickly point out, you know, you'd use the word rebellion and so forth. In a way, that's true, but in another way, I feel that I really came back to a basic Christianity I was raised with. I happen these days to go to a Greek Orthodox Church, and, you know, that's where you would find me on most Sundays. I'm a believing Christian, but what I'm not is an American evangelical of the right. That's what I'm not anymore, but I certainly am a follower of Jesus Christ to the best of my ability, which is not very much, but it's certainly where my heart is at, and the book ends with a declaration of what I would call a kind of a Christian faith that is tempered by enough uncertainty so that, you know, you have a little less hubris. You don't think you're right about everything all the time or try to make everybody believe as you do on every instance.
Have you heard of the book Myth of Certainty by Daniel Taylor?
Yeah, actually I have. Somebody mentioned it to me the other day. I ought to read it.
Yeah, he's a great guy. You know, I guess the basic premise is that doubt is more akin to faith than certainty.
Yeah, I think it is. In fact, I think doubt and faith are synonymous, and certainty in a way is synonymous with unfaith, because if you're completely sure of something, then in a way, you know, you're not in the position of doubting Thomas. You're in the position of the people who have seen and heard, or at least you think you have, and so, you know, faith doesn't really enter in because you kind of have this hubris of certainty. You know, and of course we've seen a great example of that recently with George W. Bush, who was sure God was telling him to attack Iraq for various reasons and then bring democracy to the world, and it was the wrong war and a big mistake to get into. By the way, just a footnote, my son, who was in the United States Marine Corps, served in Afghanistan and Iraq, and thank God came home alive. But we've just had a presidency based on the idea that, you know, we never have to admit we're wrong, and there's absolute certainty in everything. And we kind of see this weird mixture of politics and religion in America now through George W. Bush that has just ended. And I think that it's been a great object lesson that, you know, real faith should have a lot more doubt in it than wrong-headed certainty.
Very well said. Of course, I wouldn't expect you to be a raving evangelical lunatic living in the bastion of liberalism that you do over there in Mass.
That's right. I've been in Massachusetts since 1979. Jeannie and I actually moved in the house we're in 80, and we've been there since. And I guess I have been tainted by that East Coast. I mean, we're almost as bad as Canadians, okay?
Yeah. That's why I get along so well with you all down there in that neck of the woods anyway. You said there's a couple...
I mean, Massachusetts, we even believe in health care, believe it or not.
Come on now.
Yeah, and we actually think that people ought to all have health care, which is sort of communist, I think.
What is that?
I don't know.
How nuts was your family? You've said that a few times. You've made a few comments that it was nuts growing up in your family sometimes.
Well, the nuttiness was on a couple of levels. First of all, when you grow up in a mission family, as maybe certain pastors' children or missionary kids can tell you, a child receives what they are given as the literal truth, and our literal truth is that we had been called by God to save mankind. And, you know, that sounds maybe odd for an adult, but a kid who grows up thinking that every conversation must end in witnessing about Jesus or you have failed is a kid with special burdens. You know, when children would ask me, what does your dad do? You know, as I put it in one of my novels, Portofino, some kids lied to be special. I lied to be normal. And so I would say, oh, well, he's a teacher, because the real answer would have been, well, we're sitting on a mountainside waiting for God to send the people he's chosen as the elect so we can tell them about Jesus and save them from hell. What does your dad do for a living? Well, we pray for people to send our mission funds so that we can do this work. Well, when you're young, you take that as normal. But looking back on this, I realized that as a child of missionaries who really felt called to do a certain work, I inherited that call without being given any kind of a choice about it. And the burden, of course, and the craziness comes in when you can't sit next to anybody on an airplane and just say, hey, that's a nice-looking suit, or what are you reading, and mean it. Because actually what you're doing...
No, that's a precursor to the gospel tract you're about to whip out.
That's it. So there's, you know, it's an odd thing when faith makes liars of us all by giving us an agenda which has nothing to do with loving the person who sits in front of us, but has everything to do with trying to get them to be just like me. So that's one kind of craziness. And then the other was just a personal one, and that is, I think my father was a real depressive. As I talk about in the book, there were times when he talked about suicide. There were times when he was throwing things at my mom. We had a very dysfunctional household in many ways. And the saving grace was is that Dad would admit when he was wrong and apologize, so he didn't pretend he was one thing and be another. But in terms of the people coming through, you know, here was this guy who was their guru, their leader, this pastor they were looking to, who along with a couple people like C.S. Lewis and others was, you know, the thinking man's Christian, quote-unquote, in his era. And, you know, if you have a father that's throwing a lunch tray over the balcony or a potted plant at your mother and then 10 minutes later is in the chapel preaching a sermon, you know, by the time you're 15 or so, you're starting to ask yourself some very basic questions about, well, how does this personal behavior translate into this faith that we're holding forth publicly as the truth? So that was the other sort of craziness.
How much like your father are you?
Plenty. I mean, I had to work through an incredible temper. I went to counseling for a number of years. My wife has put up with a lot of you know, absolute crap from me. And over the years, fortunately, by God's grace, she hung in there and helped me change. But, you know, as people who read the book know, and I get emails from, at least in the book, I'm no harder on anybody else than I am on myself, in the sense that I felt that if I was going to let the chips fall where they may, I had to, you know, do the same thing with me. And so, you know, I went into a time in the movie business, directed four really miserable low-budget feature films in Hollywood, totally crashed and burned.
I'm glad you said that.
Yeah, got into a sort of a very depressed state, you know, wound up shoplifting pork chops from Ralph's Grocery on Sunset Boulevard and stuffing them down my underpants because I didn't think I had money to pay for food. You know, I have been on some very low places. And so, essentially, the book is not written from a point of view of triumphalism, of, hey, I have a better way, you know, I've discovered some great truth, you know, my parents were crazy, but look at me. It's quite the opposite, and that is that I feel that, you know, growing up a little bit and having kids of my own and hitting some very low points in my own life, I look back at my parents with great compassion, and I realize that it was a tremendous burden for them to have the integrity they did, because my dad, unlike a lot of North American pastors, was not cashing in. I mean, his office was his bed. He worked on a little tray on the corner of his bed on a rocking chair. He didn't even have an office to work in, far from having a private jet, if you know what I mean. And that was the example he set. But the fact of the matter is he had real problems. And I think having grown up myself in this, at one point I was very angry, saying, oh, you know, my father's a hypocrite. He has this temper. He does this. He does that. And then, of course, when I had to walk in his shoes a few miles, I found that I sank even lower. So the message of the book is not, hey, you know, my parents screwed up, but I got it all together. It's rather that faith and compassion and doubt and these things weave together into a salvation story which goes beyond, you know, our weaknesses, and that those are weaknesses I share. So really, I haven't got any great special insight beyond where my parents got. I just see things slightly differently.
Are you also a bit of an expert on Italian Renaissance art?
Well, you know, as someone who's painted and someone who likes art and hangs around museums a lot, I don't know if I'd call myself an expert, but it's certainly a first love of mine. And, you know, as I say in the book, I think left to his own devices, my father would have been happier not as a missionary and pastor, but as an art historian. And I think, you know, if I had had my druthers looking back over a whole life, I'm glad I'm a writer, but certainly, you know, both painting and writing and or, you know, studying art is something I've been very interested in, and I do have a particular passion for the Italian Renaissance, and so, yeah, on any given afternoon you can find me in a museum if there's one within hailing distance.
Well, I'm just wondering what, you know, in processing this stuff, I mean, you're just public about this. This processing has been going on for years.
Right.
But what was the funeral like, your father's funeral? Was there any sort of cathartic moments in his funeral for you, or was there anything, I don't know, that kind of came to the surface that you didn't expect?
Well, my father's funeral was a zoo. It was a circus.
Right.
And one of the reasons I'm in the Greek Orthodox Church and I love formal, structured, old-fashioned, 4th-century liturgy is not because I think it's a faster road to heaven. you know, we're schmucks like everybody else and no more saved and or anything else. It's just that it's like the son of a crack addict, you know, longs for a stable middle-class home. You know, my father's funeral was a circus because we were burying a Christian celebrity. And so, you know, there was only one place in Rochester, Minnesota where he died at the Mayo Clinic that was big enough, and that was a local high school gym. And so, you know, we looped back the ropes, put his coffin up on the stage, pushed the bleachers back. Thousands of evangelical leaders pushed in, you know, Ruth Graham and all the rest of them. And, you know, nobody had a clue what to do because there was no liturgical ceremony. It's just sort of a Protestant free-for-all. You make it up as you go along. So my brothers-in-law preached, and then the quartet played, and then my mom said something, then they preached some more. And, you know, it essentially showed why when it comes to funerals, weddings, funerals, baptisms, you really don't want some guy to make it all up on Friday night with a guitar. You're better off, you know, going back to the 3rd or 4th or 5th century and just saying, what have other Christians done through the ages? Okay, we'll settle for that. You know, funerals and weddings shouldn't be too creative because you got enough pressure without trying to work out all the details.
If he was alive today, would you have written the book?
Yeah, I would have. And I'll tell you why. Because my father actually, believe this or not, really believed in the arts. And people often say to me, what would your dad think about this book? And I know this sounds glib, but you can just take it that I'm sincere when I say this. His biggest concern would be that it was well written. and a good book.
Yeah.
And if it was, and he thought I had nailed it, my dad was a big-hearted man. He would deal with the ramifications. You know, I had an indication of that when I got Jeannie pregnant. I was 17, she was 18, and there were people in the ministry saying, are you going to make an example of your son? You know, how does this fit in with our work? And, you know, my father's interest there was compassion and love and caring for us, not making an example of anybody. And when it came to the arts, you know, we were in the Libri Chapel, and this is back in the late 50s and early 60s when art wasn't the thing that evangelical fundamentalists did. And, you know, my dad was holding film festivals. We were showing movies by Bergman and Vittorio De Sica and Federico Fellini, nudity included.
Wow.
And, you know, evangelicals would show up from places like Wheaton College and just have a cow.
Cardiac arrest.
And in the chapel, no less, projected on a sheet hung behind a pulpit from which he was giving his Roman series the next morning. So, you know, Dad was not this uptight, anti-cultural, knee-jerk, you know. My father was not to be confused with a church lady.
No.
And one incident I talk about in the book is when we were in San Francisco in 68, you know, Dad said, oh, gee, I want us to go see a Jefferson Airplane concert. And so we went to the Fillmore West, and we sat there all night watching rock and roll. Now, you know, Dad, the last thing Dad would have been was shocked by some book because, you know, when people asked him about his own life, he never hid any of this stuff. In other words, my father was not one of his own groupies, if I could put it that way.
Sure, no. Your mom's still alive.
Yeah, and she's 94 and sadly has a lot of memory loss, and between that and the fact that she can't see because of her macular degeneration, it really doesn't come to a situation where it's, well, what does she think of the book? But I will say this, my first novel, Portofino, which is a loosely biographical work, you know, people were writing me on my mother's behalf saying, how can you do this to your mom? And I could, in all truth, write back to them and say, well, it's interesting, you're so upset because she ordered 24 hardbound copies of this book and has been giving them to her friends because she's so proud I got a good review. So I think that a lot of people who feel they need to do battle on my parents' behalf, you know, are fighting more for the evangelical status quo, which they feel is somehow threatened by some of the things I've written. But, you know, they don't remember and or have conveniently forgotten who my father really was. And he was someone on the side of art and expression and experimenting and taking risks. And that's why he had all these long-haired, crazy people following him and believing in what he was saying. It wasn't because he was some sort of uptight, pietistic, middle-class Christian who was judging people. He wasn't like that. And so, you know, my dad would be the least of my worries. It's his followers that have given me hell.
I'm just wondering, and by the way, folks, we're talking with Frank Schaefer, a son of Francis Schaefer. There's a shadow to live in your entire life. Yeah, I guess, are you always introduced like that? This is Frank Schaefer, son of Dr. Francis Schaefer. Is that?
Well, the fortunate thing for me is at least speaking for the United States, we're a very tribalized culture.
Yeah.
So if you're not into NASCAR, you don't know who the drivers are. So, you know, as long as I hang around with secular Jews, I'm fine.
You're fine. At what age, Frank, did you realize that people were sucking up to you in order to get close to your dad?
Well, you know, it sort of cottons on when you're in Dallas Airport and a lady runs over to you and grabs you and holds you as if, you know, you're I don't know what, and says, your father's already gone through security, but I just wanted to touch a Schaefer.
You're kidding.
So, when you know, if you're 14 and that happens, you kind of get your attention and you're saying,
yeah, that's whack.
What is the deal here? So, let me put it this way. In a very small microcosm, I sort of understand why Prince Charles is so weird.
Nicely said. You know, in today's post-Jerry Falwell Christianity, the helm sort of seems to be split between the old guard, Robertson, Dobson. I would even put MacArthur probably in that camp.
Right.
Even though he likes to shoot those within his camp as well.
Right.
And then the post-modernal folks who seem to be having a bit of an identity crisis, sort of emerging, McLaren, Warren, Bell, whatever. Right. What do you see from your perspective as you look at North American Christendom and these great divides?
Well, I think you articulated that very well, and I think we saw that split in action recently when Richard Cizik, vice president of the National Society of Evangelicals, was fired. You know, Dr. Dobson tried to get him fired 2 years ago, wrote a letter demanding his resignation because Cizik had the temerity to say he thought global warming was real and we should do something about it. And Dobson said, A, it's not real, and B, even if it is, this isn't good for President Bush and he's our guy, literally. How can you be so disloyal? So that kind of tells you where it's at. And now he was fired because he was on Terry Gross' show Fresh Air, and he said, you know, when it comes to civil unions for gay people, as an American citizen, I support that. When it comes to gay marriage in churches, you know, that's a different matter because it's an issue of a Christian church being able to control its own doctrine, but I'm open to civil union as a citizen in a secular culture that's in a democracy and pluralistic. Well, he got canned for that. Now, there's a lot of people, though, when it comes to a younger generation or people in the emergent or emergent church, whatever, who would support Cizik, and I think those are the battle lines. It isn't so much that those social issues are tearing it apart. It's really that it's that fundamental certainty pitted against the idea you were talking about a moment ago when you say, well, doubt isn't all bad. You know, there are people who don't want to allow for even the possibility of asking questions and feel there's a sort of a disloyalty, where there's another school of people like Richard Cizik or perhaps me, you know, who believe in the loyal opposition, who say we ought to be asking questions. And, you know, if your faith is in the midst of doubt, that's real faith. If your faith is in the midst of certainty, you're just deluded, because none of us live long enough to absolutely know anything without having to add a very key sentence once in a while, and that is, I could be wrong. And that's what you never hear coming from a real fundamentalist, but you do from people who have, I think, gotten a little more wisdom. And I think that's what the real divide is.
So you're a messy kind of a creature then. You're sort of like an Orthodox version of Mike Iaconelli.
Yeah, I go to an Orthodox church, and so one group of people think, well, how can you do that? I mean, they're so conservative, you know, liturgical. But, you know, the church I go to, just speaking on a very personal level, you know, when people in the church read Portofino or Zermatter Saving Grandma or my latest book and they see there's some language in there and so forth, you know, these are normal people. These are people you'd actually want to know on a daily basis, not just because you have some religious affiliation with them. They're not shocked, because the Greek Orthodox immigrant tradition, at least in the United States, and I would imagine this is true in Canada, is just, you know, regular old working class stiff who started restaurants and painted boats. They don't care, you know, if you got a word here and there, or, you know, there's a scene where somebody runs through a room naked. I mean, they're not waiting for the Jesus Saves message. They're just wanting to read a book because it's a book.
Yeah, they're not worried if you're going to drop the F-bomb in the first 10 pages of your book.
No, and so when I first went to this Greek Orthodox church and I had a local book signing for Portofino, this is back in 1990, you know, or 92 when it came out, all these little old ladies said, we're coming to your book signing. And I said, oh, no, you know, now I'll never hear the end of this. And they all bought the book, and then I figured next Sunday I'm going to catch it in the neck. And they were all coming up to me saying, oh, I laughed so hard, it was so funny. You know, I'm thinking, what kind of Christians are these? You know, they should hate the book.
Oh, man, you kill me. What do you think, Frank, is what's it going to look like when we become post-postmodernal or post-emergent?
I think we're going to rediscover our roots, and I know that sounds trivial, but I think we're going to get back to first principles. And honestly, I don't want to be some starry-eyed Obama maniac, but you got to understand something. We have an actual, believe this or not, we have an actual believing Christian in the White House now. We have someone who had a real experience with Christ in the church he was in, who gave a lecture in 2006, long before he was running for anything. Probably the best talk I've ever heard, 39 minutes on the balance of church and state in North America. He really gets it. He's a true intellectual. He's a thinker. He reads. And the people who he has been reading are the kind of people who have something to say. And so I think what's going to happen is we're going to see that it isn't an either-or choice between progressive politics on one hand and what you might call a very traditional faith on the other, that you really actually can have both. You can admit we're in a pluralistic, diverse society that has to accommodate secular Jews, Hindus, Muslims, Christians, on one hand, people who believe in legal abortion, people who don't. On the other hand, you can go to church and be grateful for a traditional sermon, for a liturgy that's not embarrassed to talk about the Trinity, for traditions that don't change with every fashion that comes along, and that you don't have to juxtapose these things. So I think we're going to be moving into an era where we're going to love our traditions in some way and yet be open to the stranger in a new way that we haven't been for a while. And at least I hope that's where we're going.
The book is called Crazy for God by Frank Schaefer. How I grew up as one of the elect, helped found the religious right, and lived to take all or almost all of it back. Did the publisher give you grief about that lengthy little diatribe?
Actually, you know, the funny thing is I had a shorter subtitle and they kept adding to it. And eventually, you know, I just went with it. But the funny thing is, you know, when I'm talking about the book and someone says, what's the subtitle? I can never remember it.
No.
Look, so honestly, if you had said, oh, tell us the subtitle, it's so funny, I'd have to be saying, oh, no, you know, I'm dyslexic, I've been drinking or something. The dyslexic part is true. The drinking part is only partially true.
Partially true, yes, of course. If you were invited to maybe a big giga church to speak, which one would you most likely accept? This sort of sounds like a Tiny Talent Time question here. If you were invited to a giga church to speak, which one would you most likely accept?
I would go to the church that let me sell books and take the cash.
You really are from the Northeast, aren't you?
Yeah, I would just say, listen, you know, I don't care. Just let me do the book table.
Yeah.
And, I think I would, listen, I go anywhere. You know, it's so funny. You know, people write and say, why do you write for the Huffington Post? They're left-wing, they're liberal, they hate everything your father stood for, they hate everything you stood for. And I write back and I say, are you listening to yourself? I mean, haven't we seen this before? Why are you keeping bad company and talking to the unsaved? I mean, since when are we only supposed to be talking to ourselves?
Ding, ding, ding.
I mean, I thought the whole point was that you bear witness to what you see as good and right in a place where, there's an actual discussion. I mean, when it's just, and by the way, to be fair, the left does this too. I'm always shocked, speaking at the Huffington Post, that when you read the comments, most of them, 90% of the time, are from One Direction. The problem is these days, at least in the United States, and I think it's true in Canada too, because you guys are all reading the same website, is we have all these little tribalistic enclaves. Nobody talks to each other.
No, you're right. Yeah, that was one of the things that frustrated me enough to start doing the show 6 years ago when I came back from pastoring in Australia and decided that if I knew what I knew about me, I wouldn't want me to be a pastor either.
Right.
I was very frustrated at the tribal nuances that were still, toting things like flannel board presentations at big Christian media conferences and stuff.
Right.
It was disgusting. I don't know. I don't know whether I'm bored with it. I mean, I'm a little ADD. You know what ADD stands for,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely. I know the technical thing, but what's your meaning of it?
It stands for attention deficit. Boy, your hair looks good.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Is that it?
That's pretty good.
All right. Last week on the show, I asked the question, is there anything that you used to believe or practice in your spiritual life that you no longer believe or practice? How do you summarize that for you?
Yeah, I can summarize it. I guess, it's interesting. I didn't know you'd ask that question, but I'll give you my snap gut response to it, which is usually probably better than if I'd had a chance to think about it.
Okay.
And that is, I don't see salvation as an in or out, black or white situation anymore. In the born-again sense, I see it as a journey. And so what I no longer believe is that you are saved or lost in some eternal sense because of some magical formula you say or don't say. I really believe it's the content of your character and that we make our own destiny and that God really wants and loves everyone. And essentially, we're all saved. What we do if we're lost in this life and perhaps the next is just to reject that love. But it isn't a formula. So it doesn't boil down to right belief, because who can be right about anything? I mean, how do you even know when you say the words, I believe in Jesus, that those are the same words other people mean? Just like how do you know when you see red, it's the same red I'm seeing? You know, the only thing we can do is rely on the fact that either love pre-exists everything or it doesn't. And if it does, then God is love. And so I don't believe anymore that the world is divided into saved and lost. I think we're all on a similar path, and this path is a struggle and a journey, and it really boils down to trying to literally follow Christ and not trying to believe so much as to follow. And I don't know if that makes sense.
Well, okay, but are you then now slipping into the moral relativism side of theology?
No, not at
life?
All, because I think that Christ is the way, and that we approach Christ knowing that he's the Son of God and who he is, and that's who Christ is. But I think that the emphasis rather on correct belief, which is sort of creedal and contractual and legalistic, should rather be on life. And the real question is imitation of the person. You know what taught me a lot was these books I wrote on the Marine Corps, like Keeping Faith, the one that I was on Oprah with when my son was in the Marine Corps. And I did a lot of research and was down on Parris Island watching the training. And, those drill instructors don't tell Marines, recruits, what to do as much as show them. And their words are literally, follow me. It's actually kind of eerie coming from a Christian background to watch a drill instructor march off at the head of a column, a platoon of young recruits, and his instruction to them is do what I do, not do what I say. He shows them, and he yells at them when they don't imitate him. That taught me something. And I think that we read the Bible much too much through a Protestant lens of rationalism, as is, it's a contract, and we're trying to figure out the rules, rather than as a history, in terms of how do I behave? How do I follow this Christ? So, you know, better someone who's never heard of Christ but is living like him than someone who knows the theology and doesn't follow the life, if I could put it that way.
Well, you know what? I'm kind of bugged that it's taken me this long to find you, basically. I mean, we're close to the end of the interview here. I really have appreciated your time, but I just, the stuff that's coming out of your yap is fantastic.
Well, anytime, you know, you want to talk to me, it's my pleasure. So you know how to find me, and I'll be glad to do this anytime you want.
No matter how good a cause, when you think you're on a mission from God, you eventually get crazy. It's quite a quote.
Yeah, well, you know, the Blues Brothers movie kind of had it right. I mean, people who think
mission
they're hearing voices
God.
And have been specially sent are sort of nuts, and I came from a family that really believed that with all the best intention of the world, but it's sort of a road to hubris and arrogance. It's better, as I say, I think, rather than looking for special leading and thinking you've been chosen, to just see yourself as another human being who has been given this opportunity to follow Christ and get your life together. And, you know, that's really how I see it. Rather than, I've got this message everybody's got to hear, rather, how do I get my life together so that at least my granddaughter, little Lucy, who's 5 months old, grows up saying, you know, my grandfather wasn't full of crap. He said and was the same thing. How about that?
Okay, but to push back on that quote, Mother Teresa, nuts? Billy Graham, nuts? I mean,
well,
I know a lot of nutters out there. We all know them.
Let's just take Mother Teresa.
Yeah. The Dark Night of the Soul, 40 years.
Would we take anything she said seriously if she hadn't done what she said? If she had just sat in London in a nice flat in the West End talking about charity?
Mm.
I mean, who was Mother Teresa? Mother Teresa was a doer. That's why we care what she believed, or the Dark Night of the Soul, or all the rest. You know, one of the reasons that a lot of people like Billy Graham, and I'm not a huge fan, I've known Billy personally, and I talk about him in the book. I don't dislike him either. He and his daughter Gigi and I were very good friends when we were young. But the fact of the matter is, you know, one of the things Billy did right is he wasn't a thief. I mean, that sounds pretty obvious, but, you know, he didn't accrue all sorts of personal wealth. He used it for what he said he was using it for. And, you know, in a way, that always spoke louder than anything he said. So, you know, I really do think following is more important than saying.
The problem with the evangelical, or as you like to say, evangelical slant on writing and all art is that in itself it isn't worthwhile. It must serve some higher purpose.
Right.
In the evangelical's case, that's bringing people to Christ.
Right.
How do you feel about The Shack?
You know, I haven't read it, and that's not a cop-out. I'm not avoiding it, so I don't have to be asked about it. I just haven't read it, so I don't know. I do feel, though, that, you know, people have riffed off C.S. Lewis and Tolkien a little bit, thinking that, you know, somehow allegories of the actual scripture are what Christians ought to be writing. I know Frank Peretti kind of got into that with some of his writing, and other people have. And I've kind of gone in a different direction, and that is, you know, the first concern, again, is not so much the saying but the doing. And so, you know, one needs to learn how to write and actually write a book people would want to read for entertainment purposes as a book, not just as an excuse to evangelize. And so I think a lot of times when you put an evangelical spin on things, you lose sight of the first priority, which is not, you know, how do I save people first, but if you're going to be a writer, how about trying to be a good writer? And if you're going to say something, may it come out as a natural extension of who you are rather than, okay, you know, here's a clever way to write a story that will get people saved.
Right.
I don't think the books say nothing, and I don't think, I would hope that someone reading Crazy for God or my novel Portofino or other books would understand by the end of it that I'm a person of faith, but they would do so in an oblique manner that actually comes out just like it would in a conversation over a drink without beating people over the head.
Well said. Very well said. Has your wife, Jeannie, had a similar spiritual journey to you, or is she sitting there rolling her eyes and, you know, going, my goodness?
My wife, Jeannie, has been sitting there for the last 39 years saying, what did I do wrong?
How
on earth, out of all the men in the whole world I could have entangled with, I get this crazy kid from Switzerland, you know, of all the gin joints in all the world.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, Jeannie has basically just been, you know, trying to keep up, and she's wonderful. But in all seriousness, she did come into the Orthodox Church after I did, and one of the reasons she did is just she saw that it was quite healing for me, not because there's any magic solution there, but personally, I had to get out of evangelicalism or lose my faith. And it wasn't really a question of, oh, this is better. But for me, you know, it's like someone who's been raised in an ER. I mean, at a certain point, they've just seen enough blood and they got to quit. That's the end of it. And so she was relieved, and she enjoys that kind of more laid back. less, you know, I guess, fevered approach to faith.
In your epilogue here, your son John wrote, "Although I didn't understand it when I was growing up, I've realized since that my father lives and works on almost everything he does with a kind of frenetic desperation."
Right.
In the prologue, I said that the only answer to who are you is when. What was true for prologue is doubly true of epilogue. We never arrive. There are no final answers, only a series of snapshots taken along the path of frenetic desperation.
Right.
You're an exhausting human being. I cannot imagine being married to you.
It's terrible. And, you know, I think everybody should always just, you know, once or twice a year should send my wife flowers and condolence notes.
I think that'd be, well, now I would put my wife in that category as well.
That's true. And, you know, fortunately, Jeannie's really tough. Her grandfather was a blacksmith in a small North Dakota town who went there to play baseball and shoe horses. And so, you know, she's got that in her. And, you know, luckily for me, I married someone who can, you know, give it out. I mean, thank God she's tough, because she's had to sort of slap me down a number of times and put me in my place, and has done so with a, you know, a regularity which is tiresome from my point of view, but has been good for me. And she and I have found a good way to live, and, you know, we become friends, but it's because she's hung in there. And there is something to be said for a Christian view of marriage that says, look, this is for keeps. So even when it goes bad, let's get over the rough points, because something good will follow. And in our case, thank goodness, you know, we hung in there.
Well, speaking from one guy who got his girlfriend pregnant, had a daughter named Jessica, and while I got my girlfriend pregnant, I was in ministry as well, to another who follows a very similar path.
Right.
Now you're 57?
57, yeah.
Grandchildren, what do you want for your grandkids?
That's a good question. I mean, here's the weird thing. In a way, you want them to wind up where you did, but go through the steps, because if they start where I'm starting and then go into left field as far as I've gone from where I've begun, they're all going to be living in outer space and be Hindus. What I'm trying to say is that, you know, somehow that stability my parents gave me, much as I've kicked against it, was a good thing. And so what I'm hoping for them is that somehow you can give them the stability, but at the same time some of the freedom, and find that balance. And so, you know, I want my, to be very frank and very serious for a moment, I want my children to follow Jesus Christ. I want to be in the kingdom of God with them someday. I want the same thing for my grandchildren, but I don't want them to have to see it through the lens of my craziness. I don't want this to be granddad's or dad's religion. I want it to be their own faith. And so it's a very delicate balance, and I claim no expertise on this, because we're all just, you know, nobody goes through it until they go through it. I mean, in a way, I wish I'd been a grandfather first and then a parent, if I can put it that way. How do you tell children what you believe, but at the same time not make it your faith you're sharing so that it can become something they discover? And that delicate balance, I don't have any great wisdom on how to do it, other than just a day at a time. And you know, kindness goes a long way, and empathy and compassion. I think being able to admit you're wrong and say you're sorry when you know you're wrong is something that helps build relationships with children. And so that's one thing I did learn from my dad that has gone right, but that story hasn't been written yet. I mean, my kids haven't finished their life, and my grandchildren are just growing up, and, you know, check in 50 years, see what happened to them all, but right now it's a work in progress.
FrankSchaefer.com is the website. Frank, it has been an absolute honor.
Hey, it's my pleasure, and I really enjoyed this very, very much. So anytime, and thank you so much for thinking of me.
Thanks, mate. I hope we chat again.
Yeah, me too. Anytime.
Thanks. Bye-bye. Frank Schaefer on the Drew Marshall Show. Again, frankschaefer.com is the website. Schaefer spelled S-C-H-A-E-F-F-E-R. Wow. Wow. Really did enjoy that. Again, the book is called Crazy for God: How I Grew Up as One of the Elect, Helped Found the Religious Right, and Lived to Take All or Almost All of It Back. If anything, it's a very well-written book, that's for sure. When we come back, we're going to open up the phone lines, talk about a couple things. Does swearing offend you, or are you one of those cool Christians who swears every once in a while? And then we're going to play some comedy clips for you. We just lighten up the show at the end of the day, because usually I got nothing to say by then, believe it or not. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
The fire, the sun, keep me burning.
Like what you've heard? Listen again online at drewmarshall.ca.